We're back! We're back! Welcome to The Distraction! I'm Drew, that's Roth. How you doing, Roth?
I'm good, man. What's happening?
You're back in New York after spending 8 months in Maine, aren't you? Are you, is it weird to see buildings and pedestrians and things of that nature?
Well, it seems like everybody's been putting on airs, building tall buildings for no real reason. I myself don't really care for it. That's my normal speaking voice now. I was at the Jersey Shore last week, not in Maine, and that
Hey, you in Jersey?
It was a really powerful experience there. The town that I was in was—they really backed the blue, Drew. They wanted everyone to know. People would raise Blue Lives Matter flags on the beach where they set up with their family, just so that you knew that the whole time that they were at the beach hanging out, they were also thinking about cops.
Did they have like a Wonder Boom pill too, and they were blasting Toby Keith at max volume too?
Yeah, there was a lot of, well, it was like the sort of like new country where all the songs are sort of like, I'm driving drunk, but it's not that bad because I live in a rural community. And like just like, but like real like party shit that like, I don't know. It also
Jason
seemed like it was trying too hard
type
to me. Like if you have a Philadelphia accent, you don't need to listen to like Morgan Mason or whatever the country artists of the moment are named.
That is true. Also, but I'm glad that you're giving me some new Jersey Shore stereotypes because I'm dated, you know. I think of Jersey Shore, I think gym tan laundry and all that stuff. And there's still plenty of, you know, gel nail trash and shit on the Jersey Shore. But I want a little bit of evolution in how I absolutely unfairly treat these people, or actually it's actually
well,
quite
you're
fair.
Not wrong. It's just like the way that if you're like, oh well, I think of all red wine as having these attributes, but there's terroir to it, man. This was the Philly Shore. It's different than the North Jersey Shore.
Yes, I would like to be consistently accurate in how I depict the horribleness of denizens of Manasquan. That's what
the one thing about this town that I want to mention before we, and I can segue into our guest for this, is that there were no trees anywhere in the town. So it was hot as fuck the whole time.
What?
The houses were on these little lots, and they had been built up high, I think in part because of hurricane stuff, because it was on a barrier island. So presumably the water meets in the middle of it, you know, every 3 months, no matter what. But I don't understand exactly how that means no trees, but it was like the entire area was in direct sunlight.
Oh.
So it was the closest thing that I can imagine. Like, I mean, whatever. Obviously, there's a whole cultural mishmash there because there's a gabagool area or sort of, you know, element to it. And then there's the, you know, sort of pop country music and the Blue Lives Matter element. But then also, it's what I imagine like a gated community in Arizona would feel like. Now, we did not have Patrick Wyman onto the podcast today to discuss what living in Arizona is like.
Actually, we did.
But. Yeah. Pat, how wrong am I? Also, hi. Welcome.
Okay. Well, hi. Thank you very much for having me. I've now lived in Arizona for a year. I have a lot of thoughts on the types of guy that live here. I'm constantly discovering new types of guy. I found a new type of guy the other day that was very exciting. It was about a 50-year-old. She's about 50. Real leathery face.
Nice.
Vaping like crazy in a Mazda Miata with the top up.
As one must.
And you could tell she was just thinking about her useless son that she had with her first husband and how he's never going to amount to shit. And, you know, I just hope that he can stay out of prison for another 6 months because then he's going to start his course at the ITT Tech. Like, this is, you could see all of these thoughts going through her head as she's puffing away on this vape. And I was excited because it's not that often that you get to see a new type of guy in all that glory, like just sitting next to you on a 6-lane surface street. So
I'm excited just to see a Miata. I don't even know, like, the idea of that there's a whole weird vape intensive inner life happening in it is delightful.
I mean, it was really a stunning experience.
This is where I note that my father owns a Miata, but you should not feel bad about that because he bought it like in 1992. So actually,
Miatas rule, dude. No one's judging a Miata.
No. And he used to, and I think for the first 20 years he owned it, he called it a Mazda, and we had to correct him, and he never ever took the correction. Anyway, our guest is Patrick Wyman, world's beefiest historian and the author of The Verge, Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. Those 40 years are 1490 to 1530. And if you want to pick a difficult subject matter to portray accurately and vividly and entertainingly, you'd be hard-pressed to pick one more difficult than 1490 to 1530. Patrick, I want to talk to you about the book, and so does Roth, but I want to talk more about Arizona guys first. What other Arizona people have you encountered, you know, out and about the desert lizards
Okay, so this is, and I feel like this one is probably closer to the outside stereotype of Arizonans. So this is a extremely tanned, late 30s fail son who drives a very large truck and yes. wears a hat with a flat brim. He's got a brightly colored polo shirt, probably purple. I feel either purple or pink. And he's like a lot of stubble going on, but you can't tell if that's just because he's been hungover for 3 days or because he's cultivating the look. He's definitely cheating on his wife, whom he married at 25. And you know, this guy, he works for his father's or uncle's real estate company. It's not clear which. This is a distinct type of guy who's out there. You can see him gathered around the end of that truck, definitely not doing work of any meaningful kind. This is a distinct
Orange type. County energy to me. Am I picking up some elements there, some commonalities?
It's very Orange County, but this guy went to Arizona State as his first choice.
Nice. Oh, excellent.
there are those couples in Arizona and in SoCal where, like, it's clear that they have these marriages that are absolutely fucking fantastic for like 4 months,
right?
And also, like, I had another joke and I forgot what the fucking joke was.
No, it's all right. I think the thing with Arizona stuff, I'm going to pick it up and just keep on moving, that I'm not prepared for is that all the houses that, I mean, like, that this guy would live in a house that, it's like the house where Cliff Kingsbury ran the Cardinals draft. You know, like, it's got, like, one of those things, like, a bunch of black rocks that has fire coming out of it somehow, and then there's also, like, an infinity pool, but, like, you can't go in it. Like, it's just, that's for a look-upon sort of scenario.
That's it. That's what I was going to say. Like, they have shitloads of money, and there's absolutely no indication of how or why they would possibly ever be able to obtain such money.
This is the American story right now. It's like the whole mystery of like all these people that just fly from state to state to do anti-vax protests. And I'm like, well, you have to pay money for those airline tickets, right? Like, what are you taking that much time off from your job? Do you even have a job?
Yeah. So there's a guy who lives like a street up from me, and he lives in what I can only describe as a tasteless fortress. Nice. And he has Blue Lives Matter license plates, which they sell in Arizona. They have thin blue
line.
Wait,
like a state plate? You can get like an alternate thing?
Yeah, you can get like an Arizona state license plate that has the thin blue line on it.
So not the frame, but the plate itself.
The plate itself, yes.
Yeah. So a commemorative plate for Blue Lives Matter.
And it says like protecting public safety. I'm like, you drive an Audi. How are you protecting public safety? This is not clear to me. But so this guy lives there and he drives like a $100,000 car. But he's kind of always home in the middle of the day, like shooting hoops but he's always shooting hoops again in the brightly colored polo shirt. And I'm like, what is the deal here? His wife looks extremely unhappy. His children are very bad at basketball. That's all I know about them. And I'm like, what is your deal, guy? I want to ask him, but I don't want to talk to him. So this is a conundrum. I'm forced to fantasize.
Yeah, like basically, like if you assume that it has something to do with cryptocurrency, which doesn't seem like an unfair assumption given the amount of time that he spends outside, and then like you already have your answer. Like if you ask, then you fucked up.
I was at an audition once with a bro who had like the frosted tips, and he was from Arizona. He's like, can't wait to get back to AZ. And I didn't believe that anyone in Arizona actually called it AZ. Like, I think he just did to impress
people.
You mean
people. The guy from the Nas record?
I don't know.
I can listen to his single again?
No, I mean, this is a white guy. I just refuse to believe that there was anyone who could credibly call Arizona AZ and not just be laughed right out of the room. But Patrick, you live in Arizona. Am I wrong?
No, people actually call it AZ.
Oh,
so the kind of charming thing about Arizona, this is both a positive and a negative, is that it's provincial. It's not like, like New York is a global city. Los Angeles is a global city. Like Austin, Texas is a global city at this point, right? Seattle, Portland, they're global cities. They just happen to be in the spot that they're at. Like Phoenix is a regional city. It is like its job is to be a center for Arizona. And so like everybody here went to Arizona or Arizona State. Like they have the license, they have Arizona, University of Arizona and Arizona State license plates. Like they're like, they work in businesses that have everything to do with Arizona. So like they work in real estate or they work in like law firms that serve the local community. Like it's really, it's like a provincial city of like 5 million people, which sounds weird, but it explains a lot of the very peculiar cultural characteristics that exist here.
There's one extra cultural tension that is sort of unspoken here, but which I feel compelled to mention, is that Patrick Wyman is from a different Pac-12 sort of folk way. So this is like, there's an additional tension there about like, I mean, it's different. You're a large fella. No one's going to mess with you or anything like that. Is living your USC truth difficult for you there? Has this been like a harder thing in terms of like watching games? I guess obviously no one's been watching games anywhere in public the last year, but.
So I think it would be weird if I were as into USC football as I was a decade ago. Mm-hmm. So I loved USC football through my undergrad and for the first few years of grad school. And then as I was in my, like the fourth year of my PhD, also at USC, I was like, I feel like I've had enough. I feel like I've like, and especially because I went to USC during the Pete Carroll years. And then Pete Carroll immediately became the head coach of the Seahawks, who were my NFL team. And so I've just gotten a shitload of Pete Carroll over the last two decades.
That is a
and,
lot of Pete. That's a lot of gum.
There's, I cannot tell you how much gum I've seen chewed by that man or how many Pete Carroll 9/11 jokes I've heard also like variations on the same. So it kind of destroyed my love of USC football. Though Lane Kiffin, the day the sanctions came through, bummed a cigarette from me. That's the kind of day Lane Kiffin was having.
Hell yeah.
He just
rolled up on you. Was like, hey partner.
I was walking, smoking a cigarette as I was going from the gym to the history department, which was extremely on brand for me.
Yeah,
in
I was
like
say,
2010 or 2011.
Pat Wyman lifestyle posting right here.
Yeah, I was just and Lane Kiffin is standing out there. He's looking real haggard outside the football building, and he's like, "Man, can I get one of those cigarettes?" I'm like, "You can, Lane. I understand. I get
That's a great story.
Not only do I know what you're going through, everyone that follows football in the United States knows exactly what you're going through at this moment.
That's such a Lane Kiffin thing where, like, once a year or once every other year, he does something cool, and you're like, all right, Lane's all right. And the rest of the time, he's a total piece of shit. But then he's like, if you ever asked me for a cigarette when he was looking all just fucked up and, like, drunk, I'd give him a cigarette if I had one, no doubt about it.
That's the Lane Kiffin experience. Is if he were a total piece of shit all the time, you could just write him off as Monty Kiffin's fail son. But he has those moments. It's a sad, sad thing. There's also, if we wanted to go deeper down this rabbit hole, Jim Mora made a throat slashing gesture at me once. So
just cause see you and did it, or did you do something to prompt it?
I did something to provoke it. I was real. I was real drunk at a Seahawks game the sole year that Jim Mora was the Seahawks head coach, and he'd been talking all this shit about how they needed to get tougher, and they were playing the Bucks in Seattle in December. Again, I was hammered, and the Seahawks were getting blown out. Josh Freeman was the Bucks quarterback, which tells you a lot about
perfectly carbon dates this to like three grim months of 2009 or whatever.
I think it was 2009 or 2010, and I went down next to the field and I started heckling Mora as I did when I was in my mid 20s. And he somehow heard me because the stadium was fucking quiet. Everybody had left. He turns around and just goes.
Unbelievable.
That was a real, just pure throat slashing gesture from Jim Mora. That's one of my proudest sports memories.
That's something that as somebody who I have not done a ton of heckling at games, all that I did as a younger, like as a kid, basically, like it feels good in its moment until like, you know, that someone heard you and then you're like, ah, man. I had that with Brad Lowhouse at a Nets game when I was a child.
Look at you.
I was yelling at him, and I was like, Lowhouse, you're terrible. And it was like a Nets game when I was a kid, so there was like 35 people there. Like, it wasn't hard to identify which butthead was yelling that. And he like looked over at me, and we didn't exactly make eye contact, but he was like looking in the direction of that, and it was all I could do not to be like, I mean, for like relative to NBA guys, like obviously like you're the, it just felt awful about it.
Oh, see, you weren't drunk enough. If you get drunker,
that was 13. Yeah,
you no regrets.
Turn the clock forward a few years, and I would have really committed to the bit.
Actually, Patrick,
like, hey, your hair looks dumb.
Patrick, I should ask you about USC because we're at the cusp of the real beginning of the college football season. Like, there were like six shitty games last weekend, but nobody gives a fuck about that. Like, actual like ranked teams are going to start playing this weekend. Are you still cheering for USC? Which, by the way, there's no school better positioned to benefit from the new NIL rules than USC. But Clay Helton is still the goddamn coach. So how do you feel about that? And do you care?
So you have put your finger on the pulse of the problem, which is that Clay Helton fucking sucks.
Right.
He's just like, it's amazing that when you have a school that's willing to shell out $5 million a year for a head coach that you settle on Clay Helton. Like,
yeah.
It defies description. It's not like I would be enthusiastic about USC football if all of a sudden they hired a head coach that I liked. And, you know, I feel weird at this point about paying really close attention to 18-year-olds on a field. It feels slightly odd to me. But I would watch games if it weren't Clay Helton. At this point, I'm staging like a football hunger strike until he gets out. I'm also doing the same with the Mariners, who haven't made the playoffs since the year of September 11th. So I'm doing the same. When they fire Clay Helton, I will continue watching again. When the Mariners make the playoffs, I will continue watching again. But until that point, I'm out. They've lost me.
Yeah, but
the Mariners are just five or six trades away.
That's right. When they fire Helton, they're just going to hire another PUD, like USC and Texas. Mm-hmm. Whenever they fire somebody, it's like, oh, well, they're going to get Urban Meyer. And then they hire like the college football equivalent of Mike Richards. So it's like it happens again and again. And I don't understand why at all. Do you?
Okay. So here's my thought. I want to bounce this off you guys because I too have been puzzled by this for the better part of the last two decades. I think it has to do with the character of the boosters who have an inordinate amount of say in the hiring decisions at that level. That like we have to think of them as big, dumb, drunk real estate guys who are real concerned with chasing tail at the country club.
Yes.
Like, and so if that's your frame of reference, then you're probably not going to make great decisions about who you want to hire to run your college football team. Like you're going to have some mixed feelings. You're going to be thinking, but is it really worth paying $5 million for this? Is it, you know, so like you've got the dumb guy price logic going into it combined with, being really worried about your Viagra prescription and how much you're going to have to drink tonight.
Yeah, this is like where I think the Buddy Garrity character from Friday Night Lights was like a really instructive one to have on TV because most people will never meet an actual athletic booster. You know, like if you see them at a game, I remember I used to go to those like the Jimmy V Classic, like those like the college basketball ones that they'd have at Madison Square Garden. And it would be like there was a safari element to it, too, because it would be like all the big teams would be there, these big programs. And you'd be like, all right, well, who are the money guys that are like putting like that are paying basically like whatever Rick Pitino's salary at Louisville or something. And it would like, I didn't know what like the rich athletic booster types of Louisville looked like. And then like, you'd see them and be like, oh, right. Cause they were like maroon and they all kind of looked like things that like if Papa John had like a Quado coming out of his chest, like in Total Recall sort of scenario, like just real like wizened car dealer types. But you're like, yeah, all right, like this is the sort of person that would not just like fall for Rick Pitino's shtick, but would like live and die for Rick Pitino's honor, you know, that would like put or would spend millions of their own dollars to fire him the moment they turned on him.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. When you think of Papa John as being the like the good looking version of that guy,
that's, like, that's the Hollywood representation.
Oh God, yeah, that's so beat.
He's the sculpted, perfected representation of the type. Like
so bleak. The
only way I can think of to describe this type of guy is that they bulge in awkward ways.
Yeah,
like that's and I think that's why. Trump, frankly, was such a favorite of this type is because he bulged more bulgy than the rest of them.
Yeah. Like, he was authentic in that way.
Yeah, it was like cookie dough covered in saran wrap.
Yep.
Well, that's the thing about Trump. He was never pretend stupid. He was actually stupid in a way that, like, most of every other politician really can't be. And so then everyone who voted for him was like, that's exactly the kind of stupid that
like,
I am.
Like, he still pandered and like, inauthentically, like, when he'd get in front of crowds and be like, you guys love your Bibles, don't you, you fucking hogs?
But he did.
But they'd just be like, yeah, we love you. Thanks for noticing.
And he did. So, badly, though, that was sort of the charm of it, right? Like, oh, he don't believe a fucking word he's saying. I've tried to bullshit like this and have it fail, and it's working for him. That's great.
Yep. The rich guy stuff is like, he was the one that I have come back to lately is there's, I think it was after there'd been a mass shooting or some terrible thing where like the president was supposed to participate in a ritual of mourning, and Trump had clearly been playing golf all day, showed up at a mega church in his golf outfit, like he's wearing golf shoes on stage. It's the one picture where he doesn't have his bangs because his hair was up under his hat, so it's like pushed back. And I remember like, you know, whatever they did, like some they, you know, prayed over him and laid hands and all that stuff, and he's kind of sitting there being like, terrific. Like, wow, that's really great. Thanks for touching me. Like, sort of, but it was like that, the brass that it takes to be like, yeah, I'll go to the church after I'm done with my fucking 18 holes. And like, maybe I'm going to have a Diet Coke after. But like, that's when I'm going to participate in the mass shooting prayer that's happening right now. Like that to me was like, that's what these guys are like.
Yeah, that's peak local gentry energy.
Yep, right. Like, will not inconvenience themselves for any mass death event, but, like, they will consent to be flattered at some point, like, of their choosing.
It's just like, yeah, the single, David, you may disagree with me on this, but I feel like the single most revealing picture of the Trump era, and that speaks to bring this back around to our types of guy here, was the picture of him with all of the half-soused polo shirt guys at a country club, mm-hmm. where he's just like, he's giving the two thumbs up, and the rest of them are all red-faced and grinning and just looking real greasy with it.
Yes,
That's. I feel like that is like the skeleton key that unlocks this entire era of American history. Is just
him
that
meeting
picture.
His base.
You gotta have the you gotta have the senior font MAGA hat too. Like, just the letters are as big as humanly possible that a fucking baby would be able to read.
The large print type. Like, it should be like the only other words that ever appear in type that large are James Patterson.
So you can see it from halfway across the Phoenix airport, Sky Harbor Airport on your way out.
Let's take a break and come back and talk history as we intended to.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour, and they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit truegreen.com, TRUGREEN.com, to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
And now we're back with historian Patrick Wyman. And I want to talk to you briefly about your book, Patrick, The Verge. Because I read our excerpt, and I wanted to play Dead or Canceled with you early. Can you play Dead or Canceled real quick with us, Patrick?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, Dead or Canceled. Tell me this person is dead or canceled. Gutz von Berlichingen. Is he dead or canceled?
He's dead. Okay. He's dead.
But his legacy lives on.
His legacy lives on. And this will actually tie back into our discussion of types of guy. That Gutz von Berlichingen, the thing that I love about him as a character is that he is very much a type of guy, right? Like he's balding. He's a drunk. He hates Polish people. Like there's, he just loves
relatable posting.
Yeah.
Gutz.
Yeah, and he's like, there's a whole thing in there where he felt insulted by he wrote this memoir, and you can just picture like 80-year-old blind Gutz von Berlichingen with a literal iron prosthetic hand dictating this to some put upon nephew. He's like, Yes, Uncle Gertz. Yes, Uncle Gertz. Yes. Tell me about the time you hit the Polish guy over the head with a beer stein. Like, and so he's like, so he was a robber knight. Like, that was what he was called. There's a specific German term for it.
Wow, that's like a D&D character type. Like, it fighter is. Magic user. It's great.
He's a type of mage.
This guy got his hand blown off by a cannonball and got it replaced with an iron prosthetic, and he kept up his lifestyle of fighting and warring and drinking and fighting like random Polish guys, not even fighting the Polish, just random Polish guys. But he kept doing this into his 60s. Like, he was like 62 years old when he goes on, or 64 years old when he goes on his last campaign. And you can see that he's just fattered shit. And he's got to be kind of crammed in this suit of armor, like Henry VIII style, like old fat Henry VIII style. The armor is still there. It's sitting in his castle, which is a museum and apparently a very nice a winery also. Oh, so you can visit Gertz's castle winery and see his fat armor. But you can just see, like, this is a type of guy. There were a lot of guys like this. And that's the thing that I enjoyed about him, and I enjoyed writing about him, is like, you get these little slices of life from this character, but you're like, oh, there were just tons of exactly this guy running around Europe around 1500. And you're like, well, that's kind of fucked up.
Yeah. This is something that I really, not to turn the flattery hose on too quickly or too strong, but this is something that I always enjoyed about the Tides of History podcast and about reading your stuff about this period in general, is that it seems like there is... I think that, like, in terms of making a normal person in the 21st century care about the early part of the 16th and the late part of the 15th centuries is obviously a pretty tall ask. And there's a sort of shortcut where you're like, so you see, it's not really that different than it is today or whatever. It's like the way that, like, teachers are kind of like, you know, rap is poetry too. And you're like, oh, I'm not going to pay attention to what you're saying. In this case, though, I think it's not cheap, that there is, like, something in this that there's always been a sort of a through line in you writing about, like, basically the earliest history that anybody has a really good idea about, or at least, you know, in Western, like, history. And yet, like, there's a lesson there that you tend not to, like, hammer away at too hard. I guess, like, the question, to the extent that I have a question here, is, like what are the challenges in writing about something that is this long ago in the 21st century? Like, that's a remedial question, and yet, like, as someone who studied 20th century history as an undergrad, I never really understood what ancient historians were getting out of this stuff, or medievalists. Like, it just seemed like it was so hard to know.
So, I mean, I think it's a really good question. And what's hard about it is, yeah, like you said, it's a long time ago. But I think the thing that I try to do, and especially now I'm doing stuff on prehistory, which is, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago, is that basically I think our time scale for thinking about the world that we live in is wrong. I think that we're so inclined to think in terms of months, years, even decades. And that's not the time scale that human existence takes place on. That's maybe the scale that a human life takes place on. But In the grand scheme of things, one lifetime is a blip. You know, there have been human beings around for 300,000 years, even longer, depending on how you want to draw those lines with our relatives. And so, like, a decade here or a decade there is a pretty short thing. But that's kind of the big picture answer. The smaller scale answer is that when we try to understand why things happen in the present, like, we've got to go back further than the past couple of years or even the past few decades. And, you know, you can see the outlines of these more distant pasts kind of surfacing in the present. And the thing that ties all that together is that we shouldn't take the present world for granted. It's not like stuff has to be this way. It's not like it was destined to come together this way. And it's not like things have always been this way. The assumptions that we have about the way the world is supposed to work, like, the origins of that are knowable. You know, like, there were other ways things could have gone. There were contingencies, and I think that even as a thought exercise, it's useful to work through that and to work through the implications of, like, where did this particular thing come from? How do we understand how this worked? And even if you don't think the answer itself is all that convincing, I think there's value in the effort. in the same way that there's like value in the effort of trying to understand the value of a baseball player. Like that is as a stimulating intellectual exercise, I think you get something out of that. And I feel like you get the same out of history. But in this particular case with this book, I just think a lot of shit happens around then. And it's like, what's it like to live through a period where things are in flux and the world is changing very quickly, and the assumptions that you have about what your life is supposed to look like end up not being that way, which I think is a really common experience for people in this like 40-year period. I think that's something we can relate to in the present, is this sense of dislocation and disruption. So that's something I was trying to get at. I mean, in terms of getting people to care, though, it's always like people are, I think there's an extent to which people are people. And people do people things. And if a lot of the things that people do are stupid and self-defeating and mean and shitty. And I think that rather than, I don't try to tell like heroic stories about the past because I'm not sure there's any such thing as heroes. I like to tell stories about types of guy who are relatable. And that's not a gendered term. Like that could be men, could be women. I like to, but I think that like if you can identify this kind of peculiarities of character and like the telling detail, that takes you into this world and it helps you understand like, oh, you know, as much as things might be different, there are also things that kind of hold true.
My question to you then is, how do you find those details? Because to me, the problem is, and I noticed this because I've read Eric Jaeger's two books too, that the paper trail is very scant from those eras. So how are you able, what is the grunt work of history you have to do to be able to get a fully formed picture of not only the people, but the circumstances surrounding them? Because when you know, the excerpt that you have from The Verge, it's on The Factory, you know, you start out with a description of like the air and, you know, the earthy aroma of congealed sweat on unwashed bodies and the ordure of horses, you know, things of that nature. How are you able to get at those details when you have to sift through a pile of evidence that's 500 years old, if it exists at all?
So to some extent, there's got to be some act of creation that goes along with that, because the sources aren't going to, like, the source that I'm working with to tell about that particular incident isn't talking about sweat or unwashed bodies or the smell of horses, because they took that for granted.
Yeah, that right? was right. just like That's, the way that we don't talk about like whatever the increasing humidity or something like that.
Yeah, or like the smell of walking along a New York street in the summer, which is a distinct scent. But like if you live in New York, you kind of take that for granted. You're like, oh, this is what New York smells like.
You're not like, I'm getting some real pea notes on the street. No, you just get them and keep moving.
Exactly, and I think so. What I try to do with a scene like that is to think about the things that people took for granted or that they didn't write down, but which must have been there. So like, you know, if somebody's walking and they're wearing armor, their armor's jangling, right?
Yeah.
Now how many, they're not going to mention that, but that's part of the kind of the flavor of their world, the texture of their world. And so what I try to think about are, what are these things that must have existed that people didn't talk about, and the way that people take details for granted today, like our friendly Arizona idiot in the purple shirt. Right. Like there's an anthropology and to understanding the past that's like, try to figure out those details in the same way that you're trying to like understand the present day world, and you're taken for granted types of guy that you have to do with the past too, where you have to think like, okay, we have this person here. How are they approaching the world around them? What are like kind of the material markers that say who they are? What are the sounds that surround them? What are the scents, the textures? And so I try to get at that. And it's mostly just like, what is the stuff that had to have been there? What are the things that had to have been there that I feel comfortable putting in? I try not to invent whole scenes to the extent that I can. I try not to invent whole scenes. I try not to make people up, but I'm comfortable adding those kinds of detail when I think that this is stuff that must have been there. This is stuff I feel okay with. That.
Also, you could draw upon other accounts of people having to wear armor from different times and what that sensation is like.
Right? Yeah. So in this particular book, what I tried to do with the kind of, so in the middle chapters of this book, I tried to focus on people who weren't necessarily famous, who weren't especially well known. And the way that I did that was I tried to find interesting sources to go with. So in Goetz's case, he wrote a memoir. He wrote one of the very few memoirs written by a person of his social class at that particular time, not a literate bunch. these professional killers.
The mercenary class or whatever, not even really mercenaries. They were just sort of entrepreneurs of violence.
Yeah, they were not an especially literate bunch. There's like one other one, and that was written by a guy who was real like gung ho for the King of France. And but that even that one's interesting because that guy was wounded 27 times in one battle. He was the sole survivor from the front rank of a pike square. But anyway,
how did anyone survive an injury in 1490?
In terms of like practical care for injuries, they were really good at it. They were great at things like splinting broken bones or, you know, suturing a laceration or something like that. Like they were perfectly fine at that kind of stuff. It was that they didn't have disease theory. Right, they didn't have germ theory, so there's no real sense for like how do we deal with infection or kind of like, you know, they might have kind of folk cures for like some sort of stomach issue, but it's not like they understand the mechanics of this is why your stomach hurts. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of limited in what you can do in situations like that. But like you can set broken bones. Like, there's evidence for people setting broken bones going back tens of thousands of years. So that kind of stuff is relatively easy to fix.
Yeah, because it was almost more experienced. Like everybody broke mm-hmm. a leg or two, like just over the course mm-hmm. of their lives back yeah. in 1500. So it was like, they're just used to it. So they're like, okay, we got to figure out how to do this.
Yeah. And not all, and you can tell when you look at, skeletal evidence from these periods that like not all of them heal great. But most of them did heal. You know, you can see like that your people's bones tell a story. It's one of my favorite things is this technique called osteobiography, where you write a biography of a person on the basis of their skeleton, just without anything else to go on. And so you can tell like, oh yeah, this person broke their hand at some point. This person had a period of malnutrition because you can tell from lines on their teeth. You can tell like what their diet was on the basis of the isotopes in their tooth enamel. Like, so you can write a whole life story of a person on the basis of this stuff, and you can see like, oh yeah, this person broke this bone, but it was really poorly set. Then they rebroke it and tried to reset it, and that one didn't take, and so this person just walked with a limp for the rest of their life.
That sounds like someone who would show up on a witness stand in court a lot. Like,
oh yeah.
I want the bone story guy for this murder thing. This has become a very guy-oriented podcast. Patrick Wyman, do you want to remember a guy now?
I would love to remember a guy.
All right, your guy of the week in honor of the U.S. Open is Yvon Lendl. You remember that guy?
So I did not remember Yvon Lendl particularly well until you mentioned him here, and now I'm feeling a lot of Yvon Lendl coming back. I remember, he coached somebody, right? He coached a next generation tennis star and was somewhat famous for that.
I do believe so. Wait, this is the part where I look something up.
And here's the part where I make a pedantic distinction while Drew is looking something up on Google, which is that I think that Yvon Lendl was technically a dude, not a guy. We don't need to go into it. But
Andy,
you know,
Murray. Andy Coach, Murray.
Okay, that's Andy Murray. That's why I remember being real high about 10 years ago and watching some tennis, as one does. And the announcers having a long discussion about the glorious career of Yvon Lendl.
That's actually a good sport to watch while high because it's so intense and it keeps going.
It's intense, but it's repetitive, which is exactly what you want in a sport that you're watching whilst stoned.
Yeah. Oddly soothing. I remember Yvon Lendl. It's still in my head. Back in the day, Snapple came out with an energy drink.
Snap-up.
Yes, that's right. And Lendl was their spokesman. And I still remember the ad copy because he goes, people say to me, Yvon, you play like you have ice water in your veins. Not so. It's a snap up.
Yep.
And
I
remember the whole goddamn line. And it pops into my head. Just
the fact that I still remember that it's called snap up is like, whatever. I guess like as a fellow ad man, you have to tip your cap to this being extremely good copy because it's been tormenting both of us for 3 decades at least.
Yeah. Roth and I are clearly best friends because we remember the same exact stupid shitty ads from the exact same time in history.
Yeah, there's a whole, I don't know, it's like 2 or 3 episodes ago that you just sang the whole Juicy Fruit jingle right on the damn podcast. Everybody
I did.
Can hear
there's
it.
Nothing, there's nothing I love more than the Juicy Fruit jingle with you. Hey, and we're going to do more guy stuff in the fun bag, Patrick Wyman. This is from Michael. And Michael writes in, what position in sports has the most guys to remember. I'm torn between bullpen pitchers and backup QBs. Which position in sports do you have more guys you remember, Patrick?
So I would say probably, I probably remember more backup quarterbacks. So I'm Kyle Bowler, whose wife, I believe, was recently in the news for some big time anti-vax stuff.
Yeah.
Yes.
Against Carrie Prejean. She's been on several times.
That is absolutely peak remembering a backup quarterback guy territory is when you remember that his wife has done some anti-vax stuff. That's like, I remember the Kyle Bowler years. John David Booty, I believe, was mentioned in the question. John David Booty left high school at 17 to not become the starter and wait behind Matt Leinart for several years. It's tough for a variety of reasons. John David Booty, we got, some of my personal favorites, Josh McCown, been around forever.
Yeah.
We can go on and on and on. Yeah, backup quarterbacks
are a rich vein with that. For me, like relief pitchers, there's so many different types of them. There are different types of backup quarterbacks too, that like Kyle Bowler's the guy where they're like, he can throw it 110 yards if he wants to. And it's like, but he's not well, but it's like, but he can do it. And then, but yeah, there's different types. Like no one would ever say that about Josh McCown. Whereas like with relief pitchers, there's like, the difference between a Todd Coffey type, like a guy that just kind of is shaped like the Grimace and throws as hard as he can, like, and plays for a million teams. Like the difference between that guy and even a Mike Fetters, who is also faintly Grimace-y shaped, but had an entirely different approach, that like there's a lot there to explore. It's just like you have to be willing to commit to knowing who relief pitchers are. Whereas like backup quarterbacks, there's only 30, of them, and they tend to move between teams.
I'd like to give it up to two other positions too. One is just golfer, like Steve Stricker, or like Larry Mize or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then also like particularly immobile front court players in basketball, like Brendan Haywood. Like if you were like 6'10" and slow as balls, and you always turn the fucking ball over, and your jumper looked like a crane accident, then I remember you very, very distinctly.
I worry that they stopped making that type of guy, that we're not seeing as many, that like the next generation of Don Reeds are just not going to play in the NBA. And that's a drag in some ways.
But they're okay. So I have several thoughts here. The first is one backup quarterback to remember, Bruce Gradkowski.
Yes.
Very lovable.
Yeah, that's a guy. So immobile front court players, Benoit Benjamin. Any Benoit Benjamin heads here?
I was a Nets fan of a certain age. I watched him. We had my friends, this is going to sound like a brag. My friend's dad worked at Drake's Cakes, and they had pretty good corporate seats at the Meadowlands. So sometimes we'd get to sit in those, and we sat right behind Benoit Benjamin and his child. His little baby, or his wife's, his wife and their child, who we called Baby Noit. And it looked kind of like him. And would just sort of look at us and make goo-goo faces. The thing is with being old is that Baby Noit is probably like a 33-year-old man now. But like it was like we...
Noity.
Yeah, but at the same time, like I always have a soft spot for Benoit Benjamin. Not because he was a good net, he really wasn't, but because he had an adorable kid and his wife seemed nice.
When he played for the Sonics, my dad somehow knew the athletic trainer for the Sonics in like 1992. And so I got to go into the locker room before a game and I got to meet Benoit Benjamin and Nate McMillan. And so I had a Sonics hat, one of the real old, like real shitty green ones.
With the disco skyline on it and like the Space Needle. Yeah.
You know it with Benoit Benjamin's signature, and I think he only played for the Sonics for 2 years. So like of all of the like memorable Sonics of that generation, I have Benoit Benjamin's autograph.
Yeah, like you met like the proto Sonic, like Nate McMillan, like a generation spanning like franchise icon, and you're like, I'd actually prefer the tall guy's autograph if that's possible.
Nate McMillan was getting his ankles iced too heavily to sign my hat.
Right. I was gonna say because he was like 36 and had played in all 82 games since before you were born.
He'd just been Nate McMillan, still a guy,
He's become such a good coach, though. Yeah.
Like the most underrated NBA coach, I think.
He's getting into that Eric Bieniemy area where he's such a good coach that it overtakes his guyness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think of him more as a coach now than a guy. Yep. I don't want to let the guy part go.
No, the guy part is integral to our understanding of Nate McMillan in the present day. Would he be a good coach had he not been a guy?
Yeah.
No.
Playmaking, defensive first. Yeah, like it's definitely like you can fit the guy characteristics into the type of coach that he is. Probably not 100%, but it's like that being correct has never really stopped me from doing stuff like that in the past.
Exactly.
Justin writes in, for a very long time, I've been fascinated with the idea of seeing a big pile of all the food I've ever eaten, not chewed up and digested, but fresh as it was when I ate it. I'm a 43-year-old man. I have absolutely no idea if the pile would fill one shipping container or like five of them. I think I would pay up to $5,000 to see that. Now, Patrick, you are a weightlifting man, so I assume that you eat a great many like whey protein powder bars and like raw steaks and shit like that. How much food would your pile, how much space would your pile take up?
It would be absolutely fucking immense. As somebody who has been overeating for decades now, like sometimes intentionally, sometimes not. I have eaten a lot of food. I'm eating about 10 pounds of chicken a week right now. And it's a lot of chicken.
This is one of the real secrets of following Patrick on social media is that, like, yeah, you get the insights, you get the, you know, sort of like historical tidbits. There's some good spoofs and goofs. Also, you see pictures of the tremendous sandwiches that he makes every day.
I make some really large sandwiches.
Super large. Like, club sandwiches at home. Like, that's a normal thing to do.
Yeah. I love a panini press. I'm a panini press guy. That's, I have used the same panini press for 7 years. It's seasoned, I think.
Nice. Savvy play.
I love that, but I love a sandwich. So I would say many very large shipping containers, most of them filled with double cheeseburgers. When I was in Ireland, when I lived in Ireland for a couple of years, they make garlic cheese fries where they put like garlic flavored mayonnaise on top of.
You lost me there.
Yeah, it's well garlic flavored mayonnaise though. It's like but it's just a mess of shit. And I ate those like every Friday night, kind of stumbling back to my apartment.
So the overeating stuff is not strictly like a gains thing for you because you are a man of lift. So you're out there getting larger and growing ass and doing squats and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But this is not the chicken is a strategic thing. The cheeseburgers are pleasure principle. Just mixing that
purely for the joy of it. Yes. Okay. Yeah. No, I've always been hovering on the boundary between strong guy who's kind of fat and fat guy who happens to be strong. Like I've always been like that. You know, that particular range. I've always been, you know, kind of 10 pounds on one side of the dividing line or 10 pounds on the other side of it. And right now I'm feeling a little slim, but I can tell there's some fluffy days coming.
Nice.
According to NPR, the average American eats 1,996 pounds of food per year. So that's a ton of food a year. So if you're 44 as I am, that's 44 tons. And I get very, very horny for like any like Ghost of Christmas Present, like food repast scene in like a movie. So I'm trying to think of like, I don't really care how much space it occupies. I just know it would be a lot of food all sitting there. And it sounds really good to see all of it.
I do agree that there's something satisfying about the image. Like I like the idea of it being segregated by the type of food to a certain extent, just so I can see how many large format Italian sandwiches that is. Like the idea of in the way that you might see like a cross section of a building or like something like that. That like I want to see how much of it is just long heroes with like little bits of mozzarella and like prosciutto hanging out the side of it. Mm-hmm.
Let's do one more. Mark writes in, I've been reading on the background story of how mealy-mouthed backstabbing climber Mike Richards weaseled his way into the Trebek seat on Jeopardy. The funniest nugget was to me how he got a start in TV working for Jay Leno, the original mealy-mouthed backstabbing climber. Are you also outraged as a Jeopardy fan, or is this not worth your ire? This is the same week, by the way, that Mike Richards was ousted as the producer of Jeopardy. He stepped in as host, and they still let him run the goddamn thing. And then everyone was like, what are you doing? And he finally got cast out of that. So, Patrick, did you care about Jeopardy? Were you outraged at all about how they mishandled the Mike Richards situation?
Yeah, so I was lucky enough to appear on Jeopardy.
Whoa, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I was on Jeopardy. I did not win. I was beaten by a very lovely guy who I actually like very much, who hosts who hosted the Cracked podcast for many years, a guy named Alex Schmidt.
Secretly Incredibly Fascinating podcast a bunch of times. Alex rules. Really good guy.
He's wonderful. Yeah, he beat me on Jeopardy.
I didn't know that he was a Jeopardy guy.
Another fix that was in.
Yes.
Someone from the media industry getting to win in a fix.
He beat me on Final Jeopardy on a question about musical theater, which I saw the thing come up and I'm like, oh, I'm fucked. There's no way.
What was the clue? Do you remember the clue and don't tell me the answer?
I don't. It was like a musical about a Scottish bridge.
Oh man, that's a bitch.
Oh, the Scottish play?
Yeah.
The answer was Brigadoon.
Oh, all right.
Oh, all right. I've heard that name, but
yeah,
man alive, like, you know, I would have said like Oklahoma.
Yeah, there was no way. I didn't even come up with an answer. I couldn't imagine.
We've had the only version of that experience I've had is on our little dorky defector-y thing where it's like, you know, I'm doing my best in answering questions and then you get to the Final Jeopardy and Luis is hosting it and it's like, a city in Florida. Which one am I thinking of? And I'm like, oh, okay. I don't know. There's a lot of them.
Coral Gables.
Yep.
Is the correct answer.
Sorry, the answer was Fort Lauderdale. But did you actually have anything invested in the Richards saga at all?
I did, mostly because I have really fond memories. When you go on Jeopardy, you sit there like the whole day. Like, so they tape like five shows a day. They tape a whole week's worth in one day, but you're there the whole time. You're watching, you're sitting in the crowd. So I got like a lot of Alex Trebek in that day. And I actually did it twice because I was an alternate the first time. So I spent two whole days sitting there listening to Alex Trebek banter and talk. And so I have like, he's kind of a weird dude.
I think that was the consensus, was that he was authentically a weird dude.
He was authentically a weird dude. And so I'm offended by the idea of replacing beloved weird dude with like greasy, shitty sex pest. Ugh, like,
yeah, TV mutant. That, like just yeah. like a normal behind the scenes Hollywood fucko.
Yeah, like that's like what you're talking about, one of our very few cultural institutions that actually values learning in any sort of public way, and you're going to put that fucking guy in charge of it? Like, that's like, say what you will about Alex Trebek being weird, but like, he read books, and I don't think Mike Richards has ever read a book.
Yeah, no, I at the beginning I was like, oh, it's kind of a letdown, but whatever, I'm sure I'll be all right. And then all these people were like, well, the fix was in, he got to rig his own search, and I was like, well, that's probably overstated. But no, it turned out to be utterly accurate, thanks to Claire McNair at The Ringer. He just totally rigged it for himself. And he sucked at the job anyway. So I was like, then now they're going to give it to Blossom, and Blossom's got takes too, so I don't know what's going
on. Yeah, Blossom, I think that's like the, if Claire is out for another scalp, and like absolutely hats off to her for reporting the shit out of that and listening to Mike Richards' awful podcast in order to write the decisive blog. It's like 40 hours of him being like, well, I don't know what type of boob is the best, but I like them all. Like just like a total butthead, like telling non-jokes for a long time. She needs to get Blossom on the record about like the germ theory of medicine. Because I feel like her 1,000% beliefs on that would shock you.
Yeah. Our guest was Patrick Wyman, and you were a fantastic guest. Patrick's book, The Verge, Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World, is out everywhere where books are sold now, and you should buy it because it's history, but this is the sort of history that is goddamn propulsive and interesting and not... It ain't the medieval shit that I was forced to learn about like in eighth grade that I hated. This is the real deal, good shit, so... Thank you for writing it, and thank you for coming on the podcast, sir. Man,
thank you so much for having me. Thank you for the kind words. As they say, first time, long time. No, I really appreciate it. It's a pleasure chatting with y'all.
Brandon Nix is our producer and engineer. Daisy Rosario is our executive producer, and our theme song is by Kirk Hamilton. You can listen to ad-free episodes of The Distraction only on Stitcher Premium, and thanks to us, you can get a free month of Stitcher Premium right now. Just go to stitcherpremium.com and use the promo code DISTRACT. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe wherever it is that you listen. And go subscribe to defector.com too, because our 1-year anniversary is coming up, Robin, to celebrate all the great Defector memories, like that one post we did one time.
I like the other post as well. I thought that one was also good. So there's a lot to talk about.
That's two posts, and there were a lot of guys, and it was so much fun. Patrick, thank you for coming on again. We'll see you guys next week.
Bye.